Drawing down the carbon in our atmosphere and lessening our overall footprint on the planet are the key elements to addressing global warming and the challenge of climate change. Carbon emissions directly depend on how we design our cities and our buildings, how we landscape and hardscape our communities. The built environment dominates our impact on nature. Hi there, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Down to Earth Tucson. To begin with, I'm very excited about this show today for two reasons. One is that for the first time in the history of Mrs. Green's world, we are going to be discussing the importance of the built environment and exactly what that means. And I'm also happy because the reason this show came about is because of a partner of ours since the very beginning, Michael Franks from Seaver Franks Architects, who is actually the sponsor of the show. We had a meeting several months ago when he pointed out that he had been all over our website, and I'm sure he was because he's an architect, very, very detailed, and couldn't find shows about the built environment and why he believed that we were missing something big when it comes to a sustainable planet, and I totally agreed with him. So here we are. I'm very excited to welcome two people here to talk about the built environment and sustainability principles. Joining me are Michael Herman, American Institute of Architects, Senior Architect, Planning, Design, and Construction from the University of Arizona, and Michael Huffman, Energy Manager, also from that most prestigious University of Arizona, says this proud alum. So, Mike, it's great to have you here with us, and I have a lot to learn, and I'm really eager to learn. So thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
Hello, thank you.
Okay, so can you each start with just giving me a sense of what your jobs are at the university? And I don't know how I'm going to do this because you're both Mike H's. So why don't we start with Mike Herman? And what is your scope of responsibility?
Okay, primarily I'm in the Planning, Design, and Construction Department, and we oversee, not surprisingly, the planning, design, and construction of renovation and construction projects on campus. My specific role as senior architect is serving as project manager during the first half of projects, during the design phase, and then we turn it over to another project manager when we head into construction.
So it's the beginning. You're at
Correct.
The very beginning
exactly.
of looking at the big picture and how it's all the wheels on the bus are going round and round.
Right, you're arranging all the puzzle pieces.
Yeah, yeah. And what about you, our other Mike?
So as the other Mike, my title is Energy Manager. I'm with the Facilities Management Department at the university, specifically with the Utilities Administration Group. And my role is monitoring analytics and project development for energy efficiency in our existing buildings, with some support to planning, design, and construction, working with them to look at how they're incorporating energy efficiency principles in a methodology that we'll be able to maintain and continue to operate. So I spend a lot of time looking at meter data and at the control systems in our buildings and working with my colleagues in the maintenance shops and in our utility central plants and our administration to determine what buildings need the most attention for energy first and how do we best address that.
Another really interesting show for me to learn about kind of not the magnitude and scope, but maybe the depth and breadth of what you have to do in facilities management. When Chris Kopeck was on, it was another kind of mind-boggling experience when you think of the just the size of what it means to be in facilities management. And energy efficiency is one component of that. There are so many other moving parts. So Mike Herman, let's start with you since you really are the first half of the equation and where it all begins. What are some of the things that you have to consider relative to the built environment? You know, what are some of the challenges? I mean, it's a big question, but it's where we all begin. So what are you looking at in terms of the overview of the built environment in your role?
Yeah, specific to being in a desert environment, it's all the same elements as anywhere in any kind of climate. I think that the two big ones which are unique in a desert are sun and water. Not that other places don't have sun and water, but it's a very different amounts and types. Water in particular, it's a valuable resource everywhere, but especially in a desert, it's an important resource of which we have very little. And as population grows in the desert, it becomes even more important. So in design of the built environment, whether it's buildings or infrastructure, trying to capture and harvest what limited water comes down as rainfall is an important element. And then kind of another key aspect of water within the desert is when it does rain, which is not very often, we get a lot in a very short amount of time. So capturing it is a challenge, and they can very quickly come down and wash away. So we need to find ways to capture that large volume of water in a short amount of time and then store it. Relative to sun, probably the two, obviously the two main elements of the sun are it provides light and it provides heat.
A lot of heat this week.
Yes, and a lot of both in the desert, maybe more so than other areas. The light, it can be it's beneficial to bring that inside into the built environment so we can have a natural daylighting, but it also can be an abundant and harsh amount or types of light in the desert. So kind of filtering and screening that is a key element. And also depending on which side of the building you're designing, I guess you see a lot of buildings, generic buildings, where every side of the building looks the same, which is a definite no-no. Because the north, east, south, and west are very different relative to many things, especially sunlight. North provides good indirect daylighting that come into a building. East and west sides of a building, when you get sunlight there, it's usually at the beginning or end of the day, which is a very low direct light, and which can be harsh heading into the morning or end of the day windows on a building. So it's actually better to avoid openings on those sides. And then the south side of a building relative to daylight, it's maybe more beneficial in the winter where it does get cold here in the desert. So it is beneficial to capture some of that during the winter. And then in the summer, again, it's beneficial to have that, but it's also a lot. So kind of filtering that or shading that on the south side of a building is a key element. And then relative to the heat from the sun, an advantage of that compared to a lot of environments where a lot of people live in temperate environments where they're more concerned about staying inside during the winter months when it's cold and snowy and icy and all those nasty things. But in the desert, that's actually a nice time of the year in terms of weather because of environment and the sun. So actually taking advantage of outdoor spaces during those the winter months is a part of our planning, not always being indoors, being able to be outside.
You know, we have listeners from all around the country, all around the world, and what I would invite people to do if they want to see the epitome of what I would call the nirvana of all buildings, no hyperbole here, is the Institute of the Environment. Mike, when you walk in there, you feel like you're in a canyon. There's water running. There's green walls. There's that lighting that you described. Everything you described, you nailed it with that building. All of the offices are light. There's natural light on the north sides of the building. And it's just a different feel. You go all around on campus, and then you go in there, and you feel like you walked into another place. It's really incredible. And for people that come to visit Tucson, I would invite them, go on the U of A campus and go into that building so you can see what kind of perfection and design looks like.
Yeah, and that's an excellent example, especially relative to taking advantage of our favorable climate during fall, winter, and spring, in that many of the spaces in that building are exterior. They're not conditioned. They're heated or cooled. In particular, circulation areas would be normally be hallways in a building, stairwells, and lobby spaces. So they're all outdoor spaces. They're comfortable, and we don't have to expend energy to heat or cool them.
You can sit out there in the summer because of the shade and because of the green that you're surrounded with. So it's like the poster child of the excellent built environment. You know, there's so many things here in the desert. As I said earlier, I'm from New Jersey. We did not have any adobe buildings back there, trust me. Thank goodness, because that's not a place for adobe, or maybe it is. What impacts do the traditional designs, designs that have been here for thousands of years, have it, do they impact the design? Because we have been desert dwellers here for thousands of years. And when I go into an adobe home and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon in a summer, and sometimes they don't have to have the air conditioning on, it kind of tells you the importance of what the built environment can do in impacting your utilities.
Yeah, definitely. And as you mentioned, people have been living here in this desert for thousands of years and in deserts around the world for thousands of years. And they developed built environment techniques to survive in that type of climate. Some of those being what's called thermal mass, very thick walls, very few windows. Of course, having fewer windows creates the issue of not much daylight, so that's a challenge in the modern world. But those very thick masonry walls or adobe walls, they slowly absorb the heat during the heat of the day. It doesn't work its way all the way through to the interior space. And then in the night, when temperatures drop down in a desert, even more so than in other climates, that heat dissipates back out into the environment. So basically not letting it get into the interior of the building to begin with. They also, in deserts, you typically see tightly clustered buildings so that the spaces in between them are shaded. Those kind of alleyways or streetways in developed areas, they're shaded from the direct sun. That also helps to direct and funnel air flows through those spaces. In traditional climates, you see people would use their rooftops during the evenings when it was cooler up there. They go up onto the roof and make that usable space.
So those are all considerations. What about space utilization? When I met with Mike Franks and he was talking to me about how much time you spend in a building and most of your waking hours are spent in them, what are some of the considerations when it comes to the utilization of space as it relates to the built environment?
Yeah, I mean, we humans have been creating a lot of buildings and we're increasingly large population utilizing those spaces. So we need to be efficient in how we create those buildings for the uses people will be using them for. Not creating something where they're only going to use it for a limited part of the day or a limited time of the year. Trying to optimize the flexibility of the space so that it can be used for many different purposes rather than sitting there empty large chunks of time. And also just from a kind of scheduling standpoint, which we, as at the university level, that's
a big
one of ours
deal.
With classrooms in particular, trying to make sure they're get to full use throughout the course of the day and aren't sitting there empty at periods of time. So just that the management of the space to maximize the use of it then helps with not having to overbuild and create more space than we actually need.
And not heat and cool it when it's not being utilized. So the utilization piece, I certainly get that. I know a long time ago we had a guest on about what it took to heat auditoriums like gymnasiums that are empty most of the time. I mean, that's a big ticket item. So just keep our basketball stadium cool for when we come in. That is a big matter to me.
What about I'll let the other Mike take care of that.
Mike, you're on the air. What about life cycle assessment? What is that all about? What does that even mean when it comes to the built environment?
The life cycle assessment means in the design of a building in a particular, probably all the bits and pieces that go into it, the materials, the resources, the systems, taking a look not just at the performance or value of them or environmental impact of those pieces at the time it's being built, but over the lifespan of the building.
How long it's going to last.
And over the lifespan of those individual pieces, making sure we're utilizing things that provide good value in the present and well into the future, rather than something, 5-10 years down the line might need to be replaced, as opposed to something that could last 25-50 years.
And a perfect segue to that is when you have that vision and you're assessing the lifestyle piece of it, where do you factor in climate change? Because we're having hotter days, more hotter days, all of that that you see measurable, I just got an email from someone that talked about how many days over 100 we've had so far, and it doesn't look like August is going to be giving us any special gifts. It was, you know, I got my car yesterday, it was 111, and then it cooled down to 109. So what do you do in terms of building for the future, knowing that it's going to get hotter and hotter pretty much in this Southwest region?
Yeah, and that's a challenge because we're typically working to design standards and codes and performances that are designed or prescribed based on current conditions.
Right.
So projecting into the future, what that future is going to look like is, yeah, quantifying that is a challenge. But I think it's probably simply a matter of rather than just designing to current basic standards is going beyond that and to best as our ability, projecting what those changes are going to mean in terms of numbers and all that, and what we need to do now so that the built environment can accommodate those changes down the line.
And for a layman like me, that means it could mean things like I'm thinking of a practical application like more insulation or a stronger kind of insulation. Probably stronger is not the word, but a more, you know, effective type of insulation. I mean, is that one of the things that you can do and put, you know, more ceilings on the roof? Like, what does it translate to in layman's terms for what you can consider? There's not that much because it's the building, the exterior and interior.
Yeah. Insulation is an excellent example of that, and making sure you, for when a building is in conditioning mode, heating or cooling, that it's relatively airtight, so you're not losing that conditioned air out into the environment. And also, part of it is, I think, maybe kind of going back to basics, it's more of an educational standpoint to we humans that are occupying these buildings, of maybe adapting our thinking or going back to when, and I'm focusing on heating and cooling as the example here, that a building doesn't have to be at a set given temperature 24 hours a day.
Got it.
And I mean, originally people didn't live in buildings way back in the old days. Lived out in nature. We adapted to the changes in temperatures from day to day and throughout the course of the year. So it's only here recently that we've kind of reconditioned ourselves now to be in the same exact temperature, whether it's in a building or in a car, going to the building, in between the buildings. So kind of it's probably a relearning and re-educational, and it's a hard habit to try and break since for, you know, a century or more we've been kind of spoiled or reconditioned into being in that one set temperature.
I would say spoiled. We're so spoiled.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. I can say it. It's like, yeah, and you can be sure I'm really thankful that I can touch my air conditioning button in this heat, because even though it's at the same temperature, it seems hotter in here when it's 110 degrees outside. So there's lots of impact or results when you do consider the built environment in the whole enchilada, plan, design, and build with the environment being sustainable and being considered. Can you just list some of the impacts for us?
Impacts on the built environment?
Well, things like, I know one example would be lower demands and higher efficiencies. So that's one, right? If you're building it so that it's more sealed, you're not going to have such a demand and it's going to be more efficient, right?
Correct. Yeah. The first step is trying to lower demands on the building, lower the amount of resources and materials that are going into a building, being efficient with all of those, so that the needs of the building in terms of materials going into it or energy that will go into it down the line to run it and maintain it, whether it be power for lighting or power for other uses or for heating and cooling in particular, which are really big loads, so that those are minimizing the demand and then maximizing the efficiency of how those are addressed so that they require less resources now and into the future.
And I would assume, though one should never assume, especially when on the air, that you incorporate into the planning control technologies that interface then with all the things Mike's going to tell us about as he sits there patiently waiting. I am going to get over there, I promise. But this is the foundation piece. And you mentioned utilizing exterior space. That's another thing to consider. And The Institute of the Environment is a perfect example of that. And then xeriscaping, you're not putting big maple trees in the on the grounds around the U of A using indigenous...
Using desert plants.
Desert plants, right. And then what about, have you done anything in terms of incorporating biomimicry? It's another one of my great passions that fascinates me. Does that come into play sometimes?
I'd like to see it come up more. I mean,
okay.
It does.
And the innovation is just happening in that field. It's so new.
Yeah, it's relatively new. Yeah, whether we've done some mimicry, some of our skins on our buildings, and in particular one, the HSIB building on one or two of the facades, kind of a rippled facade, which kind of mimicked the saguaro cactus, which has its ribs internally, and then also in its exterior skin, which is a self-shading element. So the saguaro, because of that design of its perimeter, helps shade itself from the sun, and we use that same idea on the building. And then just biophilia in general, trying to kind of provide that reconnection with humans when they're inside a building to the natural environment outdoor. It's daylight views out to nature, landscaping areas, as opposed to a view out to a parking lot or a wall of an adjoining building, or trying to bring where they're in their interior areas of a building, just elements that might mimic or kind of replicate nature, the idea of nature. Just, again, trying to get that reconnection with nature rather than being isolated in a box and completely divorced
from the outside world. It can be tied to wellness. I never forget when I went to a downtown lecture series and Esther Sternberg spoke. She is like the queen of space. And she talked about, and she has a lot of research about homes for seniors, senior living places. And if they put windows, to your point, facing a tree, the outside, their lighting, they showed improved healing times, an increase in healing times and recovery rates, because it's wellness. And that then for the employees, if you feel good about work or environment, your productivity is better, you're not as tired. So all of those things, I mean, it's really, as we say in the vernacular, it's really a thing that you are contributing to wellness when you consider all these factors.
Yeah, it is. And that's also somewhat a newer field of study, and you know, we're seeing that come up more and integrating into the discussions, because there's a lot of overlap between wellness and sustainability, a lot of those topics like daylighting and that connection to the outside, like daylighting, just types of light. I mean, people are healthier when they're in natural light, which is, it's not the same type of light or color of light throughout the course of a day. It changes from morning to midday to sunset, and that's what humans have been in for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. So when you're stuck inside a building which doesn't have that, or just one type of uniform light, that does impact the health.
And I'm
and
not
wellness.
Kidding. I couldn't do that. I need, you see my house, yeah. And lots of bright light. I need sunlight. Because if not, I'm not well, and that's not a good thing. So thank you, and we'll come back to closing questions. But now, Mike Hoffman, thank you for sitting there so patiently. And so what I have learned from some of the guests I've interviewed and from working pretty closely with TEP and working with having interviewed people from Tucson Water, technology is rocking it. That's so articulate on my part, but it's so key to making all of these things continue to go round and round. And talking to Chris, when he came on and talked about the monitoring systems, I was like deer in the headlights. So from the facilities management perspectives in your role, talk about energy management. It's your time.
So first of all, I just want to take that credit, because I don't think any of my colleagues would ever accuse me of being at a loss of words.
So I wouldn't either.
This duration of silence on my part, I think, will gain me some approval back.
You'll get
in
so
the
much
office.
Respect when you go back there.
So the first thing I would say is the real key tool to energy management at the U of A is decidedly low tech. And it really starts with my colleagues, but not just the people who do utilities. Energy management or energy consumption in the built environment is ingrained in everything else in the built environment. So one of the first groups of people that I would refer to have a key stake and provide key value towards energy management is our operations people, our custodians, and our grounds people. A dirty building will never be energy efficient, or at least you won't be able to maintain it as an energy efficient building. Dust and particulate that inevitably finds its way into the building will then inevitably find its way into energy systems, HVAC and fans and the like, and start to cause detriment. So the rate at which the level at which our custodians are able to maintain our buildings and maintain the cleanliness and the wellness of those buildings is key to maintaining the energy efficiency. The other thing about them is, you know, facilities people in many organizations, and I would dare say even at the university, we're a little bit the ghost behind the curtains.
Agreed.
Most people aren't acutely aware of how many facilities management folks are functioning in their building, doing all the different things. And our operations people, who spend the majority of the time in the buildings representing our department, are often the first people to notice something's not right. Hey, those lights seem to be on all the time. Or they don't tell you that, but they're making a point of going around and turning off lights as they make their rounds through the buildings. I've had custodians stop me to say, you know, such and such area seems to be really cold when I come in at a decidedly unoccupied hour to do my work. Maybe you should look into that. And then it goes through the maintenance. Our tradespeople are key to energy management. The people at our central utility plants, we operate different than many commercial facilities and residential facilities in that every building doesn't have its own central cooling and central heating plants. We have three very large utility plants on campus, and we run what's called a district energy loop. So the men and women that run our plants that work down in the 6.5 miles of utility tunnels that crisscross through the whole campus are key to that efficiency as well. So it really is a departmental-wide emphasis, and that's the first real step to energy management. The second real step relates a little bit back to what Mike was saying, and that's how the buildings are used. We spend an awful lot of time in these buildings. We live in these buildings, not just where we sleep, but where we work and play and eat and socialize and research and do all these things and go to Wildcat basketball games. And how we engage with the buildings has a huge, huge impact on the energy consumption in those buildings. And one of the things, I've said this to people probably more times than I might be entitled, there's only so much that planning and construction and facilities management can do to design and maintain a building to operate efficiently if the end users aren't engaging with it efficiently. I can't overcome that. I can't keep people from largely turning on lights and leaving them on. We're working on that, though.
The human factor.
The human factor is a key element. Because we are the energy demand on the buildings. If it wasn't for somebody or bodies being in an office or a classroom or a lab, we wouldn't have to turn on those lights. We wouldn't have to ventilate. We wouldn't have to cool it. So we are the demand on the buildings. And the more that we can inculcate a culture of energy awareness and sustainability awareness in how we go about our day in our facilities, that makes our job much easier because then I just have to manage the equipment that is serving that demand.
Right. And I think it's good to clarify because with new buildings, you can put the sensors in. So the lights go off and when someone comes in, you can do it. But the U of A has a lot of old buildings. it's really lots of old, old buildings. So you don't have that technology. I'm thinking turning out the lights. Now it's one of the positive advancements of technology. Mm-hmm. So what do you do in terms of when something's wrong? Like fault detection systems. How do you find out when something's broken?
So what this kind is the of bells and whistles really go off? Is the technology.
Okay.
And we have the benefit of computers now interacting with the building systems. Most of our buildings have or are scheduled to have computerized digital control systems that are monitoring the major energy consumers in those buildings, HVAC, fans, lighting, et cetera. We have 130 buildings on the main district energy. We're currently at about 12 million, or we will be at about 12 million square feet
Wow.
of facility space. There's no way to deploy enough technicians to have somebody on site finding problems proactively all the time. It's just absolutely
physically impossible.
But we have the benefit of computers. So you referred to fault detection. We are currently deploying on a phased-in schedule an automatic fault detection system, which is a computer that interrogates computers. So this system is living behind our firewalls, and it is routinely communicating with, right now we have about 17 buildings on the pilot, communicating with those control systems and retrieving from them on a very, about a five-minute interval, all their pertinent data, all the temperatures and pressures and flows and what position are these control devices in. And then we run it up to the cloud, and our partner, the software company that's our partner, runs all this data through, it's basically artificial intelligence. It's a very, very long list of machine learning algorithms that looks for problems. And then every morning I can come in and go into the system, and it tells me all the things that didn't seem to work right yesterday or last week or last month, and it turns this tremendous volume of data into actionable insight. So I can then go sit with our controls technicians or our mechanics and say, hey, this air handler did something that we didn't expect it to do, or it shouldn't be doing, or shouldn't have been doing when it was doing it, and we need to look into that. That's a huge lift for us. Data is all around us now. We talk constantly about, you know, we're in the world of big data. The challenge with data is it can come at us at a rate that me in front of a computer, I can't consume it. So you run the risk in this day and age of being data rich and insight poor. So this fault detection system is one of those key tools that is allowing the machine to make sense of the data and give it back to me in an actionable format. And it's huge. We're starting to see some real value with it. As we learn more about how to react to it and how to more effectively engage with it, we're really excited about the value it's going to bring to us across the campus. So it's turned out to be a really solid investment. The next thing that we're looking at right now, kind of a complement to that, is what's called an energy management information system or an energy information system. And it's the same idea. So I mentioned we're a district energy system. So TEP doesn't touch all our buildings with a meter.
Right.
Right. They come in at certain key points at our substations, but then knowing what the buildings are doing is entirely on us. So we do that by way of about 1,000 utility meters around campus that are looking at our electricity, the chilled water, the steam, potable water, and that's all coming back on a per minute interval. So we have this huge treasure trove of data. And then what do you do with it? So an energy information system works similar to that fault detection, where it's going to take all that utility data and pull it in and allow me to consistently, routinely process it and visualize it and draw out that insight. So rather than drilling through, you know, thousands and thousands of rows of data trying to find what's anomalous, it will give me a heat map. It will give me some sort of a regression analysis where I can look at it and go, that's not working the way it did last year. Or there's a trend here and something's not right. Or simply, hey, that building is a far worse energy performer than this one, so let's start with that one. So again, it's cutting edge in the application of the technology. We've been working at this in one form or another since way before I came to the U of A. I mean, as far back as 2009, 2010, integrated control systems were going into the energy loops, into the central plants. But now we're really trying to find better, more current tools for how to harness it. And again, it all comes down to actionable insight.
And the thing that blows my mind is like it's such a win-win-win, because you're not only helping in terms of climate change and the impact of energy use and all of that, but every university is so impacted by budget cuts. I mean, utility bills and water bills, it's a big number. So anything you can do there to improve efficiencies helps to have a healthier U of A campus overall.
Absolutely.
I mean, and I didn't even think about, when you were talking about it, all of the dorms. So it's people living in them and sleeping in them. So it's, and talk about old. There's a lot of old dorms on that campus. And you have to deal with all of that when energy efficiency wasn't even a thought. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you want to talk about that's exciting in terms of like looking into the future? It blows my mind what you talked about, to be able to watch those things, read the numbers and know what they mean. Do not ever invite me to that party, okay? Because that is not my strength. I would, however, like to go see the tunnels at the under the U of A. I'm sure it's restricted, but maybe you could get me a special pass. I'm serious. I had no idea.
Yep.
And that's really, because of what I do, very intriguing to me.
Could you do a podcast from the tunnel?
But I could
probably
record
not from
it
the
on
tunnel,
my.
But I bet you could get an interesting trip out of seeing one of our central utility plants, or all three of
and
our central utility plants.
I mean, it would be great, and yep. You can't do that with TEP because they're, you know, it's public utility and it's very, understandably,
when
very
it comes to
highly
U of A,
controlled.
You know people, though.
I do.
I'm pretty sure Chris Kokak could make that happen.
We'll see if he can make that magic happen. But it's kind of a question about, are you excited and encouraged, both of you, about what the future is bringing in terms of energy efficiency, which to me is synonymous with mitigating climate change?
On my end, I think what I'm excited about, not just specific to energy, but just the whole realm of sustainability, working within the environment, addressing climate change, is that there's just an increasing kind of desire and focus and interest on that from all components of the university, which is from the research into whether it's, you know, the water, environment, climate change, to the education, all the different programs within the various colleges in the university. I see increasingly that just educating the students and as well as educating the faculty, staff that are on the campus as well. And then within our two operations, the planning, design, construction, and the maintaining of the buildings, putting those into practice. So it's kind of addressing it from all angles within the university setting.
And maybe for the first time ever, at least since of my awareness, we have President Robbins that's really taking it seriously. And it's not just a nod and something on the shelf. I mean, he's been involved in climate conferences nationally and internationally. He's the first one that I have ever seen where it's going to be pace of the leader, pace of the team. And that helps.
Yeah, and that's from up top down and the grassroots up from both levels,
right,
to see it working.
Right.
And like we just recently, the university joined what's called the UC3,
yes,
University Climate.
I was there when that
Coalition
was announced at the Climate Action Summit in San Francisco.
With a bunch of other research,
yes,
universities around the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, kind of working together between that coalition of universities on what needs to happen at the research level and the implementation level and outreach with surrounding communities, kind of bringing all those groups together.
That's very encouraging. And I'm glad you mentioned UC3. It's exciting. And to have the president of the university know what it is and be on board with it is music to my ears. Mike, what's your response to that? Do you feel we're definitely, I'd like to say, trending in the right direction?
I think we're more than trending. I agree wholeheartedly with Mike. I think the culture at the university, at every level, in the students and in faculty and staff, and certainly from senior administration, we've embraced the challenge. Nobody at the U of A is ignorant of the challenges that we face with the environment, and having the opportunity to speak with people in our sustainability office and colleagues like Mike and others, the sense that I get is everybody's on board. And following, like you said, we're getting paced from the lead. Everybody is very excited about the culture and the environment that President Robbins has been developing and bringing about on campus. And sustainability is certainly one of those key pillars to which he refers. And I think you're going to see a lot of continued success and a lot of continued innovation and an effort coming out of the university at a variety of levels. So it's an exciting time to be in our field at the U of A.
I know, it's like finally, and it's exciting, and it's accelerating, and that's what I like to see. Is there anything that you think I missed? I really appreciate everything. I hung on your every word for both of you, because I think it's really, really critical that we start covering things like this. Are you both good?
I would just say thank you because, like I said early on, one of the big challenges for energy management is getting the dialogue to the users. Is that, you know, energy demand is by those who demand it. And your efforts with the podcast and everything that you do with Mrs. Green's World maintains the dialogue and amplifies the dialogue. And is until we make this a normal aspect of our cultural dialogue and we normalize energy efficiency and sustainability into how we go about everything else that we do, we'll never be able to truly overcome the challenges. But with the work that you're doing, it leads that way because
raising
it makes it part
awareness,
of our dialogue.
Yes, raising awareness about it. It's what I and my team live for. And I thought of this term when you were talking about all of the contributions of the custodians that are kind of like behind the scenes, the silent contributors. I think we should call them energy whisperers. Don't you like that? I think that it was like, oh, they're energy whisperers. They're telling you, they're whispering in your ear what's happening. So you know me, Mike, and I am going to have the last word here. I hope that all of our listeners have learned as much as I have from Mike and Mike about the built environment. Given that most of us spend the majority of our waking hours in buildings, knowing that there are people considering energy efficiency, water use, xeriscaping, and our well-being when it comes to building is something that is great news for us and for this amazing planet of ours. And the fact that one of our very supportive partners brought this entire built environment topic to our attention, we're going to do more about it. We're going to have more podcasts, and there's going to be more learning opportunities in the weeks and months to come because the light bulb definitely went on with us big time. So thank you, Mike Franks, for being a part of our tribe, for being a champion for the planet, and for caring enough to take the time to be all over our website and to point out something very important that we were missing. As an organization dedicated to raising awareness about what a sustainable and socially just planet looks like, we are excited about adding the built environment to the list of important topics we cover and certainly realize why it is so important. Thank you all for being a part of our world, and go out there and be the change that you wish to see in this crazy world of ours. We need you, and so does Mother Earth. So, my two mics, thank you. It was delightful. I got goosebumps a lot. I learned a lot, and so will our podcast listeners. So thanks for what you both do and for taking the time. I know you both have a lot on your list every day.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.